Welcome to Tom SciCast, and I'm your host, Tom Kennedy. Today we're going to talk about the origin of species, something that Darwin himself called that mystery of mysteries. And the question is, you know, how do we get new species? How do you replace an old species with a new species? So a species change over time, when do you know you have a new one? Or how do you get multiple species from an original population? So when Darwin published his book called On the Origin of Species in 1859, his idea was he wanted to shed some light on how evolution works. And in that book, he presented a lifetime's worth of work. He was influenced by his journey on the HMS Beagle between 1831 and 1836. And for several decades after his journey, he continually went through his collections, organized them, studied them. He also did experiments at his house. All of this was to amass evidence to support his theory that species change over time through descent with modification, and also to provide a mechanism of how species change, and that is, of course, natural selection. So if the mystery of mysteries is how do you get new species, in fact, that's what Darwin called his book, On the Origin of Species, well, the irony of ironies is literally that in his book, On the Origin of Species, Darwin never proposed a mechanism of how one species becomes a new species. Now, you might be going, well, of course, that's natural selection. Well, what we know about natural selection is natural selection causes change over time. And we know that as time goes on, you'll accumulate more and more changes in your population. But the question remains, you know, when does a population become a new species compared to an old population, or when do you get an actual new species? And that's an interesting question, right? I mean, you know, whenever you think of a species, you think of something that is unique, like a wood duck, a mourning dove, a dog, or a house cat. You know, we usually think of these as a unique entity. These are discrete. And, you know, many species, they're easily recognizable, but that is not always the case. And that confounds the species problems. And of course, the other question is that Darwin really didn't get at is what are the mechanisms by which populations become new species? We know that they'll slowly change over time, but what exactly are the factors that cause two populations to become two different species? So this sets up a dilemma for us, right? I mean, to understand the origin of species, you have to have a good idea of what a species is. What makes one species different from another species? And, you know, if you don't have a good definition of a species, well, it's hard to talk about the origin of species. And you'd be surprised. A universal species concept that applies to millions of different organisms, from plants to animals to fungus to prokaryotes, it's really hard to come up with an all-encompassing definition of a species that fits everything. And yet, we consider species a basic unit in the classification of biology. Now, since Darwin's time, the concept of species has changed a lot. Let's just recap a little bit through time. If you go all the way back to several thousand years ago to the Greek philosophers, Plato thought the species didn't change, and each species represented a perfect form. This is typological thinking. Well, Aristotle extended on Plato's ideas of species being part of the great chain of being, where you have lower and higher life forms. So you can imagine a lizard is lower than a mammal, and a mammal, of course, would be lower than a human. Now, Darwin overturned the notion that species were unchanging, and he showed that species changed over time. But it really wasn't until the 1940s when we had a really good definition of species, and that was the biological species concept introduced by Ernst Mayr and was a crucial part of the new synthesis and combining heredity and genetics with Darwin's evolution by natural selection. I mean, people believed in evolution, or they just weren't sure that natural selection was the main mechanism of evolution. Even today, scientists are still trying to figure out a good way to define species, and understanding what a species is surprisingly difficult, even today, and we've been working on this question for over 160 years. Now, some cases, you know, it's easy to determine a species. They might look similar, like two species of sandpipers. To all you birders out there, you know that least and western sandpipers can be kind of hard to tell apart. But you know, if you look at the legs, you can see that the legs on the least sandpiper are dark yellow, and the legs on a western sandpiper are black. And if you can see that, then you know that you've got two different species. So even though they look really similar, we know that they don't interbreed, and we know that they are unique species, even though they look similar. But sometimes it can be really difficult to determine if you have one species with a lot of variation, or if you've got actually different species. I'm gonna go back to birds again because I know birds. There are these little sparrows in North America called juncos, and they're quite common throughout much of North America. I love these little guys. They'll come into your feeders around Albuquerque in the wintertime. So there are several different populations of these birds. There's the gray-headed, slate-colored, Oregon, pink-sided, and there's a few others as well. Now, I can easily tell the difference between these populations. And in fact, an Oregon junco and a gray-headed junco, both of these are, of course, the dark-eyed junco species complex. To me, they look completely different. But the question is, are they actually unique species? Or are we just seeing local variation in a lot of different populations, and they truly are just one species? So before we figure out how you get a new species, let me first talk about some of these species concepts and how they've changed since Darwin and how we still use some of the ones since Darwin. In Darwin's time in the 1800s, most scientists used what is called the morphological species concept. So this is pretty straightforward. It's based on morphological similarities. How closely do you look to something? It's widely applicable. I mean, you can use this on fossils. You can apply it to living organisms. You can apply it to both asexually and sexually reproducing species. And it was the most commonly used definition of a species right up until about the 1940s or so with the modern synthesis. And the morphological species concept, it works great on things like fossils. I mean, fossils, that's all you have is morphology. And they also work really well on arthropods. Arthropods have a lot of physical characters. You ever take a close look at a dragonfly? I mean, you can look at like the size of the head, the mouth parts, the differences in the wing venation. And with a lot of different types of insects, you can look at the male genitalia. I know that's weird, but a lot of male genitalia will only fit into a certain female. It's called the lock and key. So even though a lot of insects might look really similar, you can still find morphological features to separate them out or identify them as a different species based on this morphological species concept. However, there are problems with this morphological species concept. Let's imagine a flatworm. It's a worm, right? You just don't have a lot of distinguishing characters, so how do you tell them apart? So different species might physically resemble each other, but that resemblance is only superficial. Or you might have cryptic species. Basically, these might look identical. And I'll tell you a good example, a mosquito fish. Believe it or not, there's lots of different species of mosquito fish, but I'm familiar with a western mosquito fish that we see, well, out here in the western United States. They're found from basically Alabama all along the Gulf Coast around Texas and up into some of the rivers. And then in the southeast, the deep south of Georgia, Florida, we have the eastern mosquito fish. And they look almost identical, but they are unique species. They do have some characters that you can use to tell them apart, but the reality is, but knowing where they came from is one of the most reliable ways of knowing what you have. Another problem with a morphological species concept is, what if you have a polymorphic species? I mean, think of these strawberry frogs. I've got a picture of them that I usually show to my class, and there's about 9 different color types. I would certainly have a hard time identifying all of these different variations as a single species when I come across them in the field. And in fact, I do have problems identifying frogs in the field in the tropics, because as a birder, you know, I'm looking at these minute color changes. Oh, it's got a yellow throat. Well, that one's got a white throat. Oh, that one's got black legs. Oh, it's got yellow legs. And those would represent different species. But in some species of frogs, like these strawberry frogs, Ophaga pumilo, you should go read up on their natural history of why they're called an egg-eating frog. It's quite fascinating. Well, I'll tell you, the females lay unfertilized eggs to feed the tadpoles. How cool is that? You ever thought of parental care in a frog, huh? But going back to our morphological species concept, these are polymorphic species. They look very different from each other. And another example, and this one's been a hard one for biologists. You ever studied ants? Well, you can go to a single ant mound, and you can find a queen, you can find a worker, you can find a male, and each one is going to look different. And in fact, when you get to the leafcutter ants of Central and South America, and also here in New Mexico too, there's like at least 5 or 6 different morphs of these ants that are completely different in size and shape. So identifying them as a single species could be really hard based on the morphological species concept. So in Darwin's time, when he published On the Origin of Species, all they had was this morphological species concept. While it worked some of the time, it still wasn't a really good biological definition of a species. And we didn't get one until the 1940s with Ernst Mayr, when he introduced the biological species concept. This was part of the modern synthesis, and for the first time ever, basically, we had a good definition of a species based on biology. And in fact, if I were to ask you, what is a species? Most people will immediately revert to the biological species concept, and we do that because it makes sense. And Ernst Mayr defined a species based on biological factors, and it focused on reproductive isolation. What kind of prezygotic or postzygotic barriers do you have? Oh boy, prezygotic, that sounds like a mouthful, right? Pre means before, a zygote is a fertilized egg. So a prezygotic barrier is anything that will prevent the fertilization of an egg. It basically prevents two individuals from mating. So by defining a species as individuals in a population that can freely interbreed and produce viable offspring, this was a definition based on biology, not just morphology. And it's a way of defining species across many, many taxa. And in fact, the biological species concept was so important that it's the actual legal definition used by the Endangered Species Act. There are other reasons why the species concept is really important. One of them is that by defining a species based on this reproductive isolation, you know, it kind of paved the way for understanding how populations can diverge from one another. That's how you get speciation, right? Because if you can get enough divergence between your populations where they can no longer breed together, then you have two new species. And you can't always establish that based solely on morphology. I mean, sometimes you can with the insects and their lock and key of their genitals, but not always. So, by defining a species based on biology, we can clearly identify species as a taxonomic unit that is evolving. And when they diverge enough that they can no longer intermingle, then you have speciation. And the reason why is because reproductive isolation is good evidence of evolutionary independence. So this means that a species can be a single population, or it could be several populations across a landscape. And we can go back to our juncos. Remember, we had four different populations of juncos that are look very different from each other. The gray-headed, the slate-colored, the Oregon, and the pink-sided. So now we can get at, are these actual populations or are they individual species? And one way is by looking at reproductive isolation. And we know that if there's individuals moving between the populations, that represents gene flow, and gene flow will prevent populations from diverging. So if you've got populations that can interbreed with each other, then you would assume that they are a single species with several different populations. Now, here's what's important, is that now we have another mechanism of how you can get speciation. Now, we know that natural selection causes change over time, but the loss of gene flow between populations leads to speciation because we know that gene flow kind of keeps them from diverging. But if you remove that gene flow, then these populations can begin to accumulate change over time until the point they become independent and reproductively isolated. So now, biologists armed with a biological species definition, right? Now we can look for mechanisms of reproductive isolation. Remember that prezygotic isolation or prezygotic barriers? This is basically how you prevent fertilization. And there are several examples of these prezygotic barriers. One is just a temporal isolation. You can imagine you've got two really similar trout living in the same stream, like a cutthroat trout and a brown trout. They're actually in different genera. But the point here is that cutthroat trout breed in the spring, but brown trout, they breed in the fall. That means there's a prezygotic barrier here to gene flow because they're breeding at different times. You can also have habitat isolation. You and I might look out at a field and we see all the same habitat and think these things are living together, but you might have two really similar species of beetles. One's on one type of plant and another is on another type of plant. Another example might include some fish in a river might spawn and release their eggs in the main channel, while others might move into slow-moving backwaters or even find little ponds where the water's not moving at all to lay their eggs. So you and I, once again, we see a river, but the actuality is they're breeding and spawning in different parts of that river, so they never come into contact, and that would form a prezygotic barrier. Another one is behavioral isolations, and birds are really good at this. I know, another bird example. But in North America, we have these really small flycatchers. They're called the Empidomax flycatchers. And I mean, they are so hard to tell apart. They are one of the hardest groups of birds to tell apart. And in fact, often when I'm birding, I'm like, yeah, that's an Empidomax flycatcher. Now, even though they are notoriously difficult to identify because they all look the same, guess what? They occupy different breeding habitats and they have slightly different songs. So they don't really interbreed. Even though they all look really similar, they have prezygotic isolation, and they are valid species. You know that a lot of prairie chickens and sage grouse, all the males get together and they do their fancy dances and displays all to attract mates. And if they don't do the right one for their species, there's no way they're going to attract a mate of another species. And another great example of behavioral isolation are spiders. I know. You know, you get these male jumping spiders. They're these tiny little brown spiders. The males have these kind of greenish looking mouth parts in the front. They're harmless. I call them your kitchen buddies. Don't squash them. They can't hurt you. But male jumping spiders, they're not picky, right? They'll try to mate with basically any female. The problem is this comes at a cost. To mate with a female, he's got to perform the right dance moves. He's dancing. He's got to do a series of species-specific courtship displays. While males of a different species are easy to tell apart, it's not the same with the female. So if the male goes up and starts doing the wrong dance moves in front of the wrong female, guess what? She eats him. So there's a cost for busting out the wrong moves on the females, right? But that is a great example of behavioral isolation. The males look different, the females don't, the males can't always tell the females apart, but she can pick them out based on behavior. And then in insects, and actually in a few lizards as well, there's another mechanical isolation called the lock and key hypothesis. And basically, genital morphology, the shape of the male and the female to some extent, is highly species specific to maintain reproductive isolation. And that ensures that males can only mate with a female of the same species. And this is used in flies, moths, spiders, true bugs, and even some lizards. Lizards have what's called a hemipene, and variations in the hemipenes, they'll actually correspond to the female's cloaca. So by now you might be thinking, hey, this biological species concept is pretty awesome. Well, believe it or not, the biological species concept does have some pretty big drawbacks and limitations. And for one, you can't even begin to apply it to prokaryotes. And the reason why is they all reproduce asexually. Yes, they all reproduce asexually. And horizontal gene transfer is rampant in bacteria. Even amongst things we call different species, they're not even closely related, and they're swapping around genes. It can also be difficult to apply to some plants. There are these oak trees, right? And hybridization is routine. So even though they're routinely hybridizing, this makes it difficult to determine a species boundary. And then let's return back to our juncos once again. We've got these four different populations. All right, they look really different. And the question remains, are these populations or individual species? And sometimes it's really hard to know. By using reproductive isolation as your definition of a species. And the reason why is that evolution is a process. It's always ongoing, right? So these populations, they might be in the process of speciating, right? That's why they look different, but yet they haven't diverged enough to be considered a different species, right? So that's a real problem with the biological species concept. We're trying to put a discrete barrier, an actual barrier, on something that's in the process of speciating. We're catching a snapshot in time here. Or they could legitimately be just different populations that look different from each other, but they truly are a single species because there's lots of gene flow between the different populations, which prevents them from diverging. When I was an undergraduate at Florida State, I learned something about stepping stone species and ring species. And this one really blew my mind, right? In the western United States, from British Columbia all the way down to Southern California, there's this small, lungless salamander. It's in the family Plethodontidae. I know it's weird, a lungless salamander, right? They get all their gas exchange across their skin. And it's in the genus Ensatina. So basically, these salamanders have about seven different populations, with the ancestral population first evolving about 21.5 million years ago. Now, these small salamanders, they inhabit coniferous forests, oak woodlands, and chaparral. They can't handle the hot, dry conditions of California's Central Valley. So here's what happened. They moved southward from their northern positions, and they moved and colonized areas around the Central Valley because there's a mountain range around the Central Valley providing proper habitat for them. Okay, so eventually, these populations, they're adjacent to each other. There's gene flow between these populations, and they can freely interbreed. But when you get to the southern end of the California Valley, of the Central Valley, the eastern population, which is called Ensatina clabberi, it cannot interbreed with the western population of Ensatina escholzi. So once again, you can see a problem here, right? So if breeding isolation is your factor for identifying two different species, then how do you identify two different species? Clearly, at the bottom of Central Valley, they don't interbreed, but as you go northward around the Central Valley, these populations, these adjacent populations, can freely interbreed with each other. I also mentioned continuous species, or a stepping stone species. Think about it this way. Imagine you're along the coast. It could be the Pacific coast, or it could be the Atlantic coast. And in a stepping stone species, imagine you've got a species of snails, right? And they live from Miami all the way up to, let's say, New York City. or New York. And the populations adjacent to each other can freely interbreed. But by the time you get enough separation between Miami and New York, well, those populations, the ends, cannot interbreed with each other. So once again, how would you identify that as individual species? And one of the last issues of the biological species concept, you can't test it on fossils. You have no idea if different populations in the past could successfully reproduce or not. Since the 1940s, we've come up with other definitions of a species. And one of the most widely used, because it's one of the most widely applicable ones, is a phylogenetic species concept. And it identifies species based on the evolutionary history of the population. And this is good, right? Because it fits well with the theory that all species are related by common ancestry. So another way to think about this is species form the tip of trees, right? So species become the smallest monophyletic group. And in this case, evolutionary history matters because a lineage will include the last common ancestor and all of its descendants. And to help identify a species or a unique lineage, we can use synapomorphies. And remember, these are characteristics that are derived, right? And they're present in the ancestral species and shared by all of the descendants. And there are a lot of advantages to the phylogenetic species concept. For one, you can apply it to any organism, whether it's asexual, fossil species, a polymorphic species, it doesn't matter. And also, you can apply it back to like our Junco example, right? We've got our Juncos. I love coming back to these birds because to me, they look very different. And the reason why is because they've been diverging since the last ice age, right? So even though dark-eyed Juncos form a monophyletic group, so do those individual populations. So with the phylogenetic species concept, if they are actually exhibiting some type of evolutionary dependence and they're going on their own evolutionary trajectory, then we could identify them as different species, even though the different populations can interbreed. They're just in the process of speciating. So we don't have to have this hard test of whether or not you can breed or not. Now, that being said, there are some disadvantages to the phylogenetic species concept. You can still have a difficult time knowing when a population has become evolutionary dependent from other populations and have elevated to the species level. So even back to our Junco example, you still might have a difficult time saying, huh, are they really off on their own evolutionary trajectory? How much gene flow do they have that's maintaining these populations? Or is this just a species complex where these populations are no longer diverging from each other? Fortunately, we can use genetics to get at some of these questions to find out the rates of gene flow between populations and determine their evolutionary significance. And another problem with the phylogenetic species concept, it can be difficult to establish evolutionary independence in different taxa. And lastly, a lot of the phylogenetic species concept, to collect that data to determine rates of gene flow and genetic differences between populations, well, that requires a lot of time and some money to do those genetic analysis, which we might not have the resources to do. And also, you might have to develop markers for your individual species or your lineage, and that can also take time. So even though the phylogenetic species concept using genetic data is really good, it could take you a while to get at these answers. Despite the problems of establishing a one species definition that fits all, although most people do use the phylogenetic species concept, there are some broad conclusions we can make. And one of those is, species are the smallest evolutionary independent unit. And another one is that evolutionary independence, when mutation, selection, gene flow, and drift operate on populations separately. So that's your evolutionary independence there. That goes right in with the phylogenetic species concept. And we also identify species as a boundary for the spread of alleles. What that means is, if you've got two species, they're not really interbreeding with each other That goes back to the biological species concept. But in the initial phases of speciation, as populations are beginning to diverge, there will be some spread of alleles, but over time, those populations will mingle less and less and less until they're truly independent of each other. And as a result of that, different species are going to follow a different evolutionary trajectory. And that is at the heart of the phylogenetic species concept. And then going all the way back to Ernst Mayr, the essence of speciation is a lack of gene flow and evolutionary independent units. Now that we have a good idea of what a species actually is, now we can talk about the origin of species. What causes speciation? I know, we said earlier, you know, evolution by natural selection. Right, well, that causes change over time. So now the question is, what are the mechanisms by which a population becomes a new species? So how do you get a population to become two species or a population to become a different species? And stay tuned for my next podcast where I cover the mystery of mysteries. What causes speciation? And that's another episode of Tom's SciCast.